Thanks, Julian. Well, it's good to be back at UC Santa Barbara, which is otherwise known as the University for the Chronically Sunburned. And you can tell from my red face and peeling complexion that I'm actually an alum of the school. Just hope John Ahrens doesn't mistake my ruddy complexion for nausea. But today I'm going to talk about probing black holes with gravitational lensing. Thank the organizers for allowing me to change the topic of my talk. And here is shown a calculation that I did at the last ITP workshop on black holes in 1999. And I'll get to that a bit later in my talk. Would it be possible to have the lights on? Thank you. So the outline of the talk is to summarize in this diagram on the right, which is the required gravitational lensing diagram, where we have a source whose light is deflected by a lens with some impact parameter xi. And general relativity tells us that the deflection angle is equal to 4 times the gravitational radius of the lens object, divided by the impact parameter with respect to the lens. So today I'll talk about three different situations in which the black holes first are lenses and address the question of how many black holes reside in the disk of the Milky Way galaxy. And can we weigh supermassive black holes using gravitational lensing? Next, I'll switch to the case where the black holes are the sources and address the question of what exactly are quasars. And finally, I'll talk about the situation in which the black hole is both the lens and the source, but the source is actually surrounding the black hole, and discuss whether we can actually see a black hole and measure its spin and its mass by imaging the event horizon. Now, an important quantity in gravitational lensing is known as the Einstein radius, which is the impact parameter for which a source exactly behind a point mass lens is lensed into a ring on the sky. And the radius of that source, Einstein radius is given about an AU for distances expressed in kiloparsecs, masses expressed in solar masses. And the fraction of distance of the lens to the source I'll denote as x. And it's some combination of x and 1 minus x. For the cosmological case, for a solar mass lens in a lens galaxy, this radius is more like a parsec scale. And for the galaxy itself, it can be kiloparsecs to tens of kiloparsecs. So the first topic is how many isolated stellar mass black holes reside in the Milky Way galaxy? What are their masses? What are their distribution and position in space? Estimates in the literature vary from 10 to the 7th to 10 to the 9th. And unfortunately, these estimates are very uncertain due to the uncertainty in the mass function as a function of time within the galaxy, which may depend on the metallicity of the gas that's forming stars in the particular time. The uncertainty in the cutoff mass for forming a neutron star versus a black hole. Uncertainty in the star formation history of the Milky Way. And therefore, we'd like to actually make a measurement of this given all these uncertainties. Roughly, though, in 10 to the 10th years of our galaxy, about a black hole formed every 100 years gives around 10 to the 8th black holes. So how can we detect these isolated black holes? Well, the ones we know about are the ones that actually have nearby companions. We only know about 15, and 15 is much less than 10 to the 8th. So we'd like to discover some others via accretion from the interstellar medium. And what I'll talk about today is the possibility for detecting these via microlensing, which was proposed by Gould, or has been discussed by Gould and also Alcock et al. In the context of the Milky Way halo. Microlensing light curves can be described very simply with the one-parameter family of solutions, which are just the impact parameter and units of the Einstein radius. And the time scale of an event I'll denote by tau, which is twice the Einstein radius, the Einstein diameter, divided by the velocity at which the lens or the source crosses the lens. And different impact parameters give different shaped curves from which you can measure this parameter. We would like to know the mass of the lens. And unfortunately, there's some degeneracy. This perpendicular velocity times the time scale times the speed of light squared divided by some constants that we do know, the distance to the source is usually easy to estimate, times a factor 1 minus x over x, where again, x is the distance to the lens divided by the distance to the source. When x is small, this mass can be very large. When x is large, this mass can be very small. And so varying the distance of the lens varies the mass from 0 to infinity. For very long time scale events, we actually are able to measure the projected velocity under our plane. And this is illustrated for the two longest events, one with a duration of almost 1,300 days, one with a duration of about 1,000 days. Due to the motions of the Earth, motion of the Earth around the Sun, there are actually fluctuations in the light curve, which are hard to see in this case, but when you blow up the residuals, you actually can see fit fairly well to the motion of the Earth around the Sun. And from these fits, you can actually measure the progress of the velocity of the amplification pattern across the plane of the Sun. In this case, it was about 80 kilometers per second. In this lens, there was a rather dramatic change in the amplification due to the Earth's motion, since it passed very close to the center of the lens. And the velocity inferred there was about 30 kilometers per second. Now, we know that our Sun is moving around the galaxy at 220 kilometers per second. These observations were towards the bulge of the Milky Way. And so the lenses are very close to being at the center of the Milky Way galaxy. And so you'd expect that lenses very close to the galactic center would have large projected velocities because their angular frequencies are much larger than the angular frequency at the solar radius. But the fact that these velocities are small led these authors to argue that these lenses were very close. Close lenses have higher mass, and they inferred that the mass of this object was about 36 solar masses, give or take a factor of 2, and the mass of this object was about 6 solar masses, give or take a factor of 2. This, of course, can only be done by folding through the phase space distribution within the disk of our galaxy and the density distribution within the disk. And what they failed to take into account is the fact that there are, we expect, many more lenses at lower mass. So their conclusions, Bennett et al. And Mao et al., was that the masses of these lenses were greater than 3 solar masses at 68% confidence. If they had actually included the fact that there are more stars at smaller mass, folded through the mass function of the lenses, then they would have found a much smaller probability these were black holes. The three longest events, the two, second and third, were in Bennett et al. Paper, have about a 3 or an 8% probability of being black holes. And this is simply accounted for by the fact that more distant lenses have a smaller probability of having a small projective velocity, but they're much more numerous, and that compensates for the small amount of phase space available. The longest event still has a fairly good probability of being a black hole, around 20%. These probabilities, though, depend strongly on what you assume for the mass function, and this is just for a saltpeter IMF, 40 solar mass cutoff for neutron star progenitors, and that's that means that we cannot determine for certainty what the mass of these lenses are. Now, the total number of events that you would expect for a given mass scales as the mass to the 1/2 power that comes from the Einstein radius times mass function of lenses. Well, at very long time scales, such as these events, it actually scales as the mass squared times the mass function. Since black holes have much higher mass, then they are enhanced in the tail, the long time scale tail of the distribution, by a large factor, 10 to 100 for a saltpeter IMF. So these probabilities actually are fairly large, given that there are a small number of black holes. Again, we cannot say for certain though, whether these are black holes. But with future observations, we actually might be able to measure their masses. The way this would work is that if you can actually resolve the two images created during a microlensing event, or see the motion of the average centroid through astrometry, which should be about 3 milliarcseconds, using the advanced camera for surveys, which is being installed next week, I believe, the VLT and interferometric configuration, which should be online in the next couple years, or the space interferometry mission in a longer time scale, combining that with the parallax measurement from the ground due to the Earth's motion around the Sun, you can actually break all the degeneracies and measure the mass of the lens, distance to the lens, and velocity of the lens. Out of about the 300 events seen so far, we expect there to be about one that might be a black hole. We can't say for sure which one. But OGLE has now expanded their efforts towards the galactic bulge, and they will expect to have around 10 to 3 events per year. We only have 300 out of 5 years of observing, so it will be a great increase in the total number of events. So if you can take the long timescale events and measure their mass with this technique, the mass squared weighting means that black holes will be favored about 25% for these fiducial parameters for the mass function. And thus, we expect about 3 black hole events per year. So we can hope to then constrain the total number of black holes within the disk of the Milky Way galaxy. If there are POP3 black holes, which are even larger mass, be even more interesting, but the numbers, predictions for the numbers of those vary quite a bit, and it's not clear whether you'd actually be able to have a high enough rate of events. Towards the very center of our galaxy, the 3 million solar mass black hole can create a gravitational lensing of background stars. And this shows a simulation done by Joachim Wamsgantz of the amplification pattern behind this black hole combined with a stellar cluster. For simplicity, he made this cluster of 300 solar mass black holes. There's some reason to expect that they would be drawn in by dynamical friction if there were enough of these. If you had smaller masses, then each of these bright points, which represents a star, would actually be a bit smaller, but there would be more numerous. Now, several papers recently have looked at this problem. Alexander and Loeb and Chaname, Miralda, Escudé, and Gould. What they find is that the probability peaks around a kiloparsec behind the galactic center for lensing, because that's where you get enough cross-section and also enough stars. But despite the hope of actually seeing this, it turns out you have to go to a K-band limit of around 21 to have enough sources to be able to see two images split by this black hole. And to further detect a cluster of black holes around the galactic center would be even more improbable and would require going to an even greater depth. K of 21 is easy to do if you're looking out of the galactic plane. But when you're looking right towards the galactic center, unfortunately, the confusion limits you to about K of 16 with current telescopes. So we'll have to go to the California Extremely Large Telescope or the 2020 telescope, which will get much higher resolution and allow you to beat the confusion limit. Black holes in other galaxies that are already lensing background quasars into several images can actually affect this, this central image of the gravitational lens. This plot shows the bending angle versus the image position for a variety of source positions, which are given by these dotted lines. And you can see that when the source is precise, then these curves give the bending angle for two different models of an isothermal sphere without a central black hole. And the solid line shows an isothermal sphere with a central black hole. That central black hole causes a singularity. And Mao, Witt, and Koopmans has shown that then that singularity ends up reducing the number of images by one. So you can see for the dashed line case that there are three images which are created. But when you add a black hole in, it essentially swallows the central image, and you'll have two images left, which are at these positions on the horizontal axis. In a very special circumstance where the source is a bit offset, then you can actually create two extra images due to the black hole. And then from that, you can actually measure the mass of the black hole, although it requires milliarcsecond resolution. And a factor of 10 improvement in VLBI might allow you to actually see these central images in some gravitational lenses, about 10% or so of lenses. And this actually might allow you to fill in the high mass end of the Gebhardt and Farrisi relations, because lenses tend to have very large velocity dispersions. So this is promising. It will require much more effort of VLBI looking at these lenses, because these images are highly demagnified and will be hard to see. Now I'm switching to the case in which the black holes are the sources rather than the lenses, to address the questions of what powers quasars, what are the properties of the quasar black holes, and they're accreting gas and jets, outflows. This shows the poster child of gravitational microlensing, which is the Einstein cross quasar, which has four images. Again, this central point is really the lens galaxy. There is no detected central image, maybe related to the black hole there, or a flattening in the mass distribution. And these four images actually vary independently with time. This shows a plot of the flux versus time over a four-year time scale. the time delays between these images is less than a day, you can see that their fluctuations are completely independent with time. That indicates that instead of this variation being due to the quasar itself, it's actually due to stars in the lens galaxy passing in front of each of these images. And of course, there are different stars in front of each image, so you get different fluctuations. What this looks like is rather complicated. You have this shows a random star field, laid down stars you shoot rays through. And due to the shear of the galaxy, you get these long filaments. If you zoom in on these filaments, what they look like is that the amplification near a filament for a point source goes as distance from the filament, or caustic, to the -1/2 power. This shows amplification versus position of a caustic, and this vertical line shows the actual caustic position. If you have a source of finite size, which four different sizes are shown here and show the resulting amplification patterns, for a very small source near a caustic, the amplification has a maximum that scales as the Einstein radius of a lens star divided by the size of the source to the 1/2 power. Very large sources vary as the Einstein radius divided by the size of the source, so they have very small fluctuations because they smooth over this pattern. So if you were to catch a quasar, showing up on my screen, so I didn't should have checked this beforehand. Should I take a minute to fix it or just keep going? What's here is actually a caustic crossing the quasar, and what you see is the spectrum changes as a function of time as the caustic amplifies different regions of the quasar. And won't bother diagramming this. So what you can actually do when a caustic crosses the quasar, you will see different size fluctuations as a function of frequency if the quasar varies in size as a function of frequency. And you can hope to take the spectrum as a function of time and invert it towards the profile of the quasar as a function of position, since time corresponds to position. And in the case where in a quasar model, which is described by a disk around a black hole, you can actually then invert to the spectrum as a function of radius, assuming the disk is azimuthally symmetric. This is something that Julian and I showed in 1999. Other workers have shown that you can actually constrain the X-ray continuum source size as a function of frequency and possibly distinguish different models for the X-ray emission region. And finally, there's a poster by Dave Turncheck, who shows some evidence for microlensing of the polarized flux in a cloverleaf quasar, and with that places a constraint on the size of the polarized emission region. In another lens, recently Leon Koopmans and collaborators have found evidence for microlensing in the radio. This shows two light curves of the two images in this lens, and they're only the time delay is around 47 days, which you can sort of shift by eye. And you'll notice when you do that there are very large fluctuations in this one image which don't appear in the other image, and this is very good evidence for radio microlensing. This can actually be used to place size constraints on the microarc second structure of the radio source, which in fact might be a jet with different blobs crossing caustics, creating these repetitious fluctuations. I don't recall. I believe it's rather high. You'll have to look at that paper. They do work that out in this paper. And they actually see this in this particular quasar. They see different fluctuations as a function of frequency, which are on a smaller scale than this particular fluctuation. Yeah, Roger, yeah, you know it? 10 to 12, okay. That Ski was asking what's the brightness temperature limit that you get from this, and Roger said 10 to the 12th Kelvin.
My reaction is exactly the same. Yeah. boot, which helped to calibrate my intuition erroneously, apparently.
Because the brightness temperatures are too low. They're expecting, yeah. Moving on, there's been much talk about broad iron K alpha lines in Seyfert galaxies, and much debate about their origin. If their broad redshifted wings are indeed due to gravitational redshift, then if you look at a particular frequency of the line, it should appear as a ring on the sky. This is for a face-on disk. For a more inclined disk, of course, that becomes a distorted ellipse. Then if a caustic were to cross one of these lines, what you would see when the caustic first crosses the edge of the line is an actual step in the amplification as a function of position or time. As the caustic crosses the other edge of the ring, there are two-fold singularities, so you actually get a divergence, and then the amplification declines as distance to the minus one-half. This maximum amplification is actually not infinite, but it's limited by the finite width of the ring and scales as 1 plus natural log of the ratio of the size of the ring to the width of the ring. So that now if you were to imagine a caustic crossing a gravitational lens broad iron K alpha line, then if this video works, you might see the following. This is actually a PowerPoint bug. Okay, that goes black too. So I'll have to draw it on the board. If I could have the lights. What you see is the following. I've computed the profile for an iron K alpha line, and then as the caustic crosses from large radii, then the gravitational redshift is rather small, and so you see just amplifications of the outer regions of the accretion disk or iron K alpha line. Then as it proceeds inwards in radius, then that's redward in frequency shift. And so you see a cutoff that proceeds further towards the red. Then as the caustic sweeps past the inner edge of the disk, you get the singularity, which then appears as a peak in the emission that then proceeds back out to infinity. This peak, of course, depends on delta R over R, and the width of the ring as a function of frequency depends on the turbulent broadening within the disk. So if you have much more turbulent broadening within the disk, then these peaks will not be as dramatic, and so you can hope to constrain the velocity turbulence within the disk with an observation of one of these iron K alpha lines. Now, recently there have been discovered iron K alpha lines in two gravitational lenses, and unfortunately the signal noise is not good enough for these short observations to tell whether there's a broad underlying line. Microlensing, of course, helps because it will amplify the parts of the line that are being crossed by the caustic.
What is the time scale for this?
Time scale for the Einstein cross would be about a month or two, and for a typical lens would be more like a year or so. So you have plenty of time to get lots of photons. I guess, let me just try one thing. See if I can show this movie. Yeah, try that. Still goes black. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I just did that. Thanks. The final topic is when black holes are both lens and source. And in this case, the question is, can we actually image a black hole directly? This is work I did at the ITP 3 years ago. Pardon me if you've heard this before. The question of why would we want to see a black hole directly? Well, it would be the final test of strong field general relativity to actually see an event horizon. We, in some cases, could constrain the mass or spin of a black hole, and it would probe extreme astrophysics of the inflow and outflow very close to the event horizon. Bardeen, in 1973, showed that if you saw a black hole in absorption, then it would appear as a rather enlarged shadow on the sky. Pachinski proposed that if you had a 10 to the 15th solar mass black hole in the intergalactic medium, you could see absorption of the cosmic microwave background. Unfortunately, we haven't found any such black holes yet. But a better candidate for seeing the shadow of a black hole is the accretion flow at the galactic center. And because it's accreting at a low rate, it's optically thin to Thomson scattering, not necessarily the synchrotron absorption, but that's a matter of what the accretion rate is right near the event horizon. And it emits very faintly in the radio and the X-ray, and this is either due to the small efficiency or due to mass loss. Photon geodesics, or paths in a Kerr metric, take a rather strange character. For a maximally spinning Kerr black hole rotating in the clockwise direction, photons which escape backwards actually get drawn around in the ergosphere in the forwards direction before they get out of the ergosphere and then can escape to infinity. And photons in the prograde direction sort of get flung outwards, shifting the whole pattern of the shadow for a Kerr black hole, but maintaining around the same size, around square root of 27 times the gravitational radius. Due to gravitational focusing, then the size of the black hole appears much larger on the sky, and that actually is very important for doing VLBI experiments, where every factor of 2 means in size means a factor of 2 in frequency. And if we had no general relativistic effects helping us, we'd actually have to go to outer space to do this experiment due to the absorption from the Earth's atmosphere. Now, if you imagine gas falling into this black hole, in front of the black hole, so the observer's to the right, the gas will be Doppler redshifted, and so you'll see a decrease in flux. And the paths of the geodesics are much shorter, so the total emission measure is smaller. It's effectively shadowing background light. For photon paths which go around the black hole, if the gas is now infalling, then there'll be a Doppler blue shift, and those photons will then be enhanced in their brightness as they swing around the black hole to the observer at infinity. So you can actually get a shadow which has a depression of greater than 50% due to Doppler shifts for infalling gas. Now, this angular size for the galactic center black hole corresponds to about 30 microarc seconds. This shows angular size versus wavelength. And there are two limits to actually resolving this angular size with a VLBI experiment. The first limit comes from scattering by gas in the foreground of the galactic center. And at 1.4 millimeters, there's a claim to have actually resolved the source, and it no longer follows the lambda squared dependence. So it looks like around a millimeter or so that that will no longer become a problem for resolving the galactic center source. The resolution of a VLBI experiment from the Earth is limited by the size of the Earth. So for an 8,000-kilometer baseline, then the lambda over d resolution you can get with VLBI also crosses this shadow at around a millimeter. So by going to submillimeter wavelengths, we can hope to resolve the size of the shadow with a VLBI experiment. What this might look like is the following. Here there are some very simplified models of gas infalling into a Kerr black hole. The yellow and red just show different brightnesses. Cuts through this are shown with these curves on this plot. You can see the shadow depression is greater than 50%, and the size is given by the square root of 27, roughly, gravitational radii. This shows a different case of gas orbiting around a Schwarzschild black hole with a constant emissivity out to a certain radius, limited by the current VLBI measurements. And you can see there is still a very distinct shadow that appears and cuts through this emission. And for cuts along this axis, there's Doppler boosting on one side. If then you smear this with the VLBI experiments at proposed VLBI experiments at 0.6 and 1.4 millimeters, this is simply Gaussian. It doesn't fold in the full UV plane. Then there you can see at submillimeter wavelengths, this depression is still evident, while at longer wavelengths, it gets blurred by both scattering and resolution. So it looks feasible that we can actually see a black hole event horizon with submillimeter VLBI.
Eric, the x-axis was just
that actually was, this is actually gravitational radii. Sorry, I should have explained. Now, radiation transfer in a Kerr metric that I've carried out is just use null geodesics, but one can include the rotation of polarization that's propagated on in null geodesics, which has been done by Bromley, Milley, and Liu. And what they show is this is polarization. I believe that's in the horizontal direction is depicted by green, in the vertical direction depicted by red, which are these two blobs here. You can still see this shadow, although it's only surrounded on three sides in this case, but it has a very distinct shape. And you can actually see secondary images in this particular model. On the right is shown more recent work that's poster of Avery Braddock and Roger Blanford, which I encourage you to go see on the poster session. And the total intensity still shows a shadow, but now they have included the effects of plasma dispersion. And for frequencies that are near the plasma frequency or near the cyclotron frequency, you can get very complicated effects because photons no longer propagate along geodesics, and you can get actually different paths for the extraordinary and ordinary mode. And so the Q and U Stokes parameters show quite complicated behavior. You can actually get Avery's shown you can actually get circular polarization without linear polarization. And these effects then will possibly allow us to constrain the optical depths within the flow. And then for VLBI, we can see whether we can actually resolve things with the VLBI experiment. If the flow is optically thick, then it'll just shroud the event horizon of the black hole. So I've covered black hole lensing in three different cases. The first being the case of black holes being the lenses. We can therefore look for the dark black holes. Gravitational microlensing events are now just coming to us in great number. And using the very longest of these, we can hope to measure the mass of these the lenses, and a few of those are predicted to be black holes. Using parallax or microlensing and ACS, VLTI, or SIM, we can get a measurement of the mass and therefore the mass function. Supermassive black holes can actually destroy or create faint lens images, and with improvements in VLBI sensitivity, we can actually hope to see these faint images and possibly in some cases constrain the mass of the black hole in the lens galaxy. Quasar microlensing will allow us to probe very extreme astrophysics. We can maybe, for simple models, invert the spectrum as a function of time to measure the local spectrum if the quasar is indeed comes from a thin accretion disk. For a broad disk, you might get a slightly different answer. The broad emission lines, if they exist in quasars, will actually show profiles which depend on the disk turbulence, and so we can hope to constrain models for MRI and accretion disks. And finally, we can hope to constrain the disk inclination, the black hole mass, and possibly the spin with the assumption that most of the emission comes from outside the marginally stable orbit. The final case is the case where black hole is both the source and the lens. I'm using source loosely because it's actually the gas outside the black hole that's emitting. But at VLBI at submillimeter wavelengths, which will require the Atacama Large Millimeter Array in Chile in order to anchor this experiment, we can actually possibly resolve the shadow of the galactic center black hole and possibly measure its spin if it's inclined in the right way or with polarization measurements. Thank you.
Yeah. The temperature of Sagittarius star is pretty high, so in fact, the photosphere is quite a bit larger than the event horizon. So how much contamination from the outer regions do you tolerate in order to do this kind of experiment?
Well, actually, in one of those models, I showed a case where the size of the emission region was equal to the current limits from VLBI, and in that case, there was still a very distinct shadow. And I assume.
Is that like 100 Schwarzschild radii?
It was actually, the paper claimed it was more like 40 Schwarzschild radii. But that is, if you talk to the people involved in that experiment, that's under serious contention. Yeah. Yeah.
What do you think about the possibilities of maxing or
regularizing? Oh, I should have mentioned that. Thanks for pointing that out. There's a proposal to carry out X-ray interferometry, which you have to go to outer space. There are two different levels of proposals, one with milliarcsecond accuracy, and then the final case will be microarcsecond accuracy. In that case, then, you have a very good chance of seeing black holes other than our galactic center. The next largest black hole is M87, as far as angular size, which is a factor of 2,000 times more massive, but 2,000 times more distant So it's about half the angular size for the shadow. But there are several other nearby galaxies with Maxim that you could actually resolve the shadows for, because it has microarc second resolution. So that is very exciting technology, and be interesting to see how it progresses.
Looking at the stellar kinematics against
okay.
the
edge. All right, thanks. Okay, that I don't believe at all. What that would require, if you take a look, Elliot was asking that there was a claim for having detected multiple images caused by the galactic center black hole of background stars. Given the separation, since we know the mass and distance, then you can actually measure from the separation of the images that Tal has claimed or to have picked out of the noise towards the galactic center K-band images, then you can actually say what the distance of the source is. You can also measure the amplification. What this would require are stars that have luminosity that's several orders of magnitude larger than the brightest stars that we know about in our galaxy, and brighter than a globular cluster. And he's claimed to have found something like 8 of these. So I think that would be a bit implausible that these were actually lensing of background stars. And a cluster would be too big to actually be consistent with these observations.